Hello, this is a trimmed down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select several tracks that might mean something to them and mark moments in their life. Maybe the first track that they ever heard, the first track that they might have brought to several tracks that mark moments in their life, as well as one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest today is Maria Oshodi. As well as being a playwright in her own right, Maria is also the artistic director and chief executive of Extant, a British-based performing arts company run by and for visually impaired people, providing a performance space that is inclusive for everyone. Maria's first play, The Espend, was produced as part of the Royal Court Theatre's Young Writers Festival in 1984. In 1992, Maria graduated from Middlesex University with a first BA honours in drama and English. Many of Maria's plays and productions have been performed on numerous stages across Britain and in Europe too. In Maria's Tracks of My Life, we will go on a journey from her early life growing up in Nigeria with her mum and dad, moving to London with her mum, and life in the capital as a teenager when her eyesight started to deteriorate. Maria will reflect on life growing up as a young person in London during the 80s and 90s, going to watch Madness and the Specials, as well as club life in the 90s. Maria's tracks include a wonderful track with Louis Armstrong on trumpet, a track from the two-tone movement with the Specials, to a classic rave anthem. We will then hit that big band sound from a track that featured in a very successful Extant production, Resistance, and then that final track that Maria would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. Hello Maria, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello.
Maria, how tricky was it selecting your tracks?
It was very tricky.
And your first track takes you back to Nigeria at the age of 5. What was life like back then for you?
When I think back now, it all was obviously always very sunny. And I felt the feeling I can remember of having at that time was this feeling of freedom and being sort of, being loved. And lots of people around. I was at school from a very young age, from about 3. I was in a school where I was taught by nuns and learnt to read and write when I was 3. So I had a kind of a private school education, but it was quite strict in some ways. And the emphasis in Nigeria was always on, you know, kind of reading and writing and learning the basics rather than much play. My mum was a dressmaker, but she ended up teaching in the school as well. And my dad was a printer. School ended quite early and I would be brought home often by some of the young apprentices that worked in his printing firm. And they would sometimes take me there on the way back. And I'd go into this great big, it just seemed like this immense cavernous space full of the really noisy, noisy machinery and the smell of ink in the air. You know, it was a really powerful kind of experience. And my dad worked in an office off of that main room. But I remember going through this clatter and banging and thudding of the printing presses, you know, in the place where he worked. That was really, really clear memory at the time.
Did you have sight back then or not?
Yes. You know, I was fully sighted when I was little. And so, you know, there are just that. I mean, it's funny because, you know, I was only 5. My dad, mum and dad met in Britain when he was a student. My dad was a student. Mum was a dressmaker and they met a dance. They got married. I was born. And then my dad finished his studies. And the whole aim of a lot of Nigerian students at that time was to go back to Nigeria that had just got independence in 1960. And was, you know, there's this bright kind of future that they were hoping to build for the country. And my dad wanted to be part of that. And my mum, who's English, you know, was up for the challenge of obviously living in a very different country. And I was just about one or two, and we went back to Lagos. And it was, you know, there was a lot of unrest, though, after that with coups and civil wars and things, which meant that my mum and I travelled backwards and forwards from England to Nigeria. And I think that all of that travelling and going from one country that's very different to another just created a lot of very vivid memories. And I find it really surprising sometimes when people say, oh, I don't remember anything beyond before the age of 8 or something, because my whole memory is flooded, you know, with impressions and visions and experiences and things from pre-5.
And the track that you've chosen is Speedy Gonzales by Pat Boone. Do you remember sort of that track and dancing along and singing along to it?
I just remember it somehow in the air. It must have been played at parties that were had, you know, there were always lots of parties, and all, you know, for us as children, I had big birthday parties, and somewhere in the air was this song. I never hear it because, you know, you just never hear this, you know, this music really much anymore. But if I ever do, it just brings that time back to me.
You better come home, Speedy Gonzales, away from Tannery Row. Stop all of your drinking.
A fantastic track there, Speedy Gonzales by Pat Boone, and I think I can remember that track back in the day as well. For your next track, you have moved from Nigeria to the mean streets of South London. What was it like making that move from Nigeria to South London for you and your family?
Well, it was my mum and I. My mum separated from my dad, and my mum brought me back to Britain. Things were really tough. We came back to London, and we were basically homeless, and had to live in temporary accommodation while we were on the waiting list with the council, and we were in what they used to call halfway housing, which I suppose was just like, I hope there's hostel accommodation, but it was was one up from that, or maybe it was one down. I don't know quite how to describe it, but there was like some buildings in Euston that were built for the workers who built St Pancras Station. So you imagine how old they were. And we were there for about 18 months, and everybody in that place was all waiting to get out, you know, so that's why I guess it was a bit like a hostel. They had a shared toilet, and there was no bathroom. But we were near Euston Station, so we used to have to go there and have baths. I remember that clearly. God, that's really God. And if you were in there too long, they'd come and bang on the door, and you'd have to get out if you're in the middle of having your bath or you're in this. Anyway, God, how life has changed. Anyway, we were offered somewhere in South London, which is where my mum wanted to move back to, because she'd kind of spent a lot of her young adult life in South London. We moved into a council estate in Clapham, and there again, it was full of families, not this time not wanting to get out, I don't think. Certainly for the first, you know, up to the age of sort of 11, you know, the estate was full of kids. I'm an only child, don't have any brothers or sisters. And so for me, it was just like an extended family, and it became a kind of an adventure playground. There were always people to play with. There was always something going on. It was like a kind of a magical kind of playground, really, where anything could happen, and you'd have all sorts of adventures and make up kind of team games, and the people's windows were always open, like especially in the summer, and you'd have music blaring out because people have older brothers and sisters that were teenagers, and they'd be playing all the latest records. And so it was actually fantastic when I look back on it. You know, the community, the drama, the colour, and yet life was really hard. Mm. But, you know, that when you're a kid, you're not really, you know, you obviously you pick up on the stuff that's going on in the adult world around you. But, you know, what your focus is on is on, you know, is playing and being able to, you know, have your imagination and physically kind of have the, you know, as many experiences as you possibly can. And so that's what was on offer to us. And so this song by Susie Quattro, you know, I remember the teenagers playing it, and it just really reminds me of that time in the 70s, that whole glam rock kind of feel in the air. All the music was coloured by this type of stupid beat, you know, that kind of that became the kind of stonking kind of theme of the 70s music wise. And being a kid, you know, you don't question anything about music, you're just absorbing it, you know. And this was what was, you know, one of the things that was being played.
So Susie Quattro there with Devil Gate Drive, and I can remember watching Susie Quattro on Top of the Pops back in the day. Maria, your next track is by Louis Armstrong, and I think you and your mum used to sing along and dance to this one.
Yeah, again, this is on the same council estate, and we were really hard up. We got a record player from a jumble sale. It was one of those ones where you, those box kind of record players, I suppose they must have a name, I don't know what the name is, but they're just like a box, and you lift the lid up and they're portable and you can, it's just a record player. So basically there was an arm that came across the turntable that was raised above it, and you rested the records on top of it. And then there was a mechanism by which when a record had finished playing, the next one dropped down. Yeah, it's very strange. And sometimes with these jumble sale record players, they didn't quite work. So even though you stack them up, they just wouldn't, like, then the next one wouldn't drop down. So you'd have to manually do it. But we also got our record from a jumble sale as well. They're all 78s, because this record player played 78, 33s, and 45s. So we had some 78s that were like on these really hard Bakelite type, you know, material. And then we had some vinyl, and I think this was on a 78, this record. And there were lots of other kinds of instrumentals on this 78. I think there was one by Aka Bilk, but then this one would come on. And my mum knew it, but I didn't. I mean, I had no idea what it was, but she used to come on and she used to start dancing to it. My mum was really into dancing, and particularly ballroom dance, but she also liked within ballroom dance you get Latin, and she was like into this sort of different kind of Latin stuff and anything that kind of had a good beat and a good rhythm. And so she, like in Nigeria, she used to like kind of some of the Belgian Congo type influenced music from that period of time. And this record has got a kind of a, I think, having looked back on the title of it and where it's from, it's South African. I knew it wasn't Nigerian. It wasn't like American either. I knew it was somewhere. It had some, you know, it felt like it had some other place that it came from. And when it got to the sort of chorus bit, which is the bit of the refrain, we just used to call it eggs and bacon, marmalade and toast, because it has this bit that goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Da, 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 da. And then when it got to that, we'd go eggs and bacon, marmalade and toast. Ridiculous, but that's what we used to call it, and it was our eggs and bacon, marmalade and toast song.
Were there good times back then for you and your mum?
It was hard. I mean, you know, it was a lot of struggle financially, obviously. My glaucoma was detected when I was about 10, and I was kind of, they thought I was just short-sighted. But then when the school nurse detected that there was something different, obviously, in my eyes at the school checkup, she sent me to the hospital. My mum came with me, and I was at the eye hospital, and then they all started getting very, very anxious. And that's when they realised that I had glaucoma is inherited from my dad's side of the family. And I was then prescribed eye drops and glasses and stuff. And this was obviously something really serious, and my mum took it on in a very serious way. And she was into alternative medicines and stuff, and she was really determined to find another way of dealing with my sight loss rather than going down just the orthodox route. So she was always into reading loads and loads and loads of books on the way that body works. She wasn't, I mean, she wasn't really, you know, educated in any kind of practice or anything, but she just was sort of self-taught, and she used to, you know, think about the different ways in which, you know, my body might respond to different sort of therapies that might help, you know. So I found it at the time, you know, this is kind of going into sort of, I don't know, kind of 12, 13, that kind of age. I found it quite a difficult time because it was not only the physical thing of my eyes to deal with and how that was kind of affecting me at school and life generally, but also going through these kind of the rigors of these diets, quite kind of extreme diets and things, to see whether that would have any effect on the pressures, you know, because the glaucoma is all around the pressures and stuff like that. So it was, you know, it wasn't great. I mean, compared with how, you know, the previous times I've described, you know, being younger were, this was kind of a much more serious and slightly kind of darker time, I think, in my life.
Did you accept the sight loss at the time, or was it something that took a long time to sort of really get used to and accept that it was happening to you?
It's strange, actually, because I knew there was something, you know, that wasn't right, obviously. I shouldn't be like this. It should be something like something else, and something that I used to be or used to have. But because there was all sorts of changes going on in my body anyway, you know, because I'm saying that I was around that age of sort of, you know, kind of coming to prepubescent, that time when there's loads of changes going on in your body. It's kind of a funny time to be losing your sight or your sight kind of like deteriorating, because it kind of felt like it was part of, I mean, I had no comparison. It wasn't like, you know, it felt like there was a lot of changes going on anyway. And that was just another one. So part of me just was like taking in my stride. Like that's what, well, you know, growing up, growing breasts, get my period, my sight's going, you know, it's part of the whole thing. But obviously it wasn't. And, you know, my mum was clearly concerned that it wasn't. Like, that's not what, you know, but yeah, it was quite a difficult time.
The wonderful sound of Louis Armstrong playing his trumpet on Skokiane there. Maria, your next track is one of the two-tone movements tracks, part of that scene back in the 80s. At the time, did you think that the two-tone movement said something for you and meant something for you at that age?
Yeah, gosh, wow, I should Coco. I mean, it's told me, it was like an explosion of meaning and identity for me. I was 15, it was perfect age, perfect. I mean, it was just absolutely perfect. How blessed was I to be 15 at that time and for something like this to hit the scene. And we've had punk before, cool. I remember the shock of seeing polystyrene from X-Ray Specs on Top of the Pops, and that, you know, seeing her like this mixed race girl in her pajamas and braces on her teeth on Top of the Pops was something else. I was so shocked. It was so amazing, because until then, you know, all the pop stars were just really glamorous, really white or really black, or really, if they were like, looked a bit weird, they were all white men like David Bowie, or you know what I mean? And then suddenly, you know, there was this girl who was like, you know, similar kind of color to me, just looked like all her appearance was just basically saying, up yours, you know, you know, basically. And just screaming. Well, she wasn't screaming at that point, actually. She was doing germ-free adolescence. So that, but the rest of her music was pretty screamy. And so that was something that woke me up, you know, and made me think, wow, look, she looks like me. That's great, you know. But then when Two Tone came along, admittedly, they're all blokes, but they're black and white, you know, on stage together at the same time. And the music was like this kind of punk beat. And it was like, I don't know, just looking at it and just like think, oh, this is just so great. And I had a friend at the time who was really, I'd met her a few years before, and she'd been incredibly quiet and incredibly, incredibly boring. And then suddenly I re-met her, and she'd kind of turned into this like amazing powerhouse of, you know, everything to do with music and clothes and particularly kind of underground stuff. And that was an education to me. She was really into special. She used to go to gigs. I've never been to a gig in my life. And so she said, I remember she said, well, I've just got tickets to go and see Madness. Do you want to come? Madness? Do I want to go? Where is it? The Lyceum? Oh, at night? Oh, it's like, I don't know, I haven't got anything to wear. I don't know. So I was able to borrow a Trilby hat. What is Trilby hat? And she had a tonic suit jacket, which was like an old sort of jacket from the 50s, which kind of shines two different colours. And I went to this gig. I went to a gig at Lyceum. I saw Madness, who was supported by The Beat. Oh, my God. And there was just a place full of skinheads, all sig-heiling, you know, as they did. And there was us, two young black girls in the middle of all this. What the hell? What the hell are we doing? And I think about it, you know, I think about like now and everything that's going on now. Do you know what I mean? And that was then. And it was all going on then too. But there was something a bit more kind of, maybe we were just innocent. I don't know. We just the situations we used to put ourselves in. I just think, my God, like all of my kind of safeguarding kind of, you know, instincts and stuff is just going completely on red alert. And yet we just like rock up, stand in the middle of a whole load of National Front skinheads.
I mean, did you feel quite sort of, you know, fearless at that time? Because it must have been quite strange being in that situation.
Just adventurous. You know, there was this kind of like, I don't know, when you're 15, you just do anything, don't you? You're just stupid and crazy and you just do anything. If it's there to be done, you sort of do it. And I guess I was like, my friend was like a bit more bolder than I, and I was just kind of following, and I was like, oh, she's there, I'll go, you know, and you know. But anyway, this this song kind of kicked it. Well, actually, no, I lied. It was this album. Yeah, this album was the one which, you know, Gangsters was on and, you know, Message to You, Rudy, and all that. But this particular song, Do the Dog, has got all of, in the lyrics, has got all of that tension at the time that there was between all these different youth cults, you know, the first line, you know, all you punks and all you Teds, your National Front, Natty Dreads. It's there, you know, and the energy of it and the feeling of, you know, being in the inner city and like never knowing which movie would turn around the corner, who you're going to come across, and that you would had your statement clothes on and they would have their statement clothes on and you never know where it would lead to. And music was really clearly identified, you know, who you belong to. And it was really visceral and powerful and addictive.
So the Specials there with Doing the Dog, which is a real song of a movement and a time. And the next track takes you to another bit of a movement and a time, the rave scene and the dancing and going out clubbing and everything else. Can you remember those times being out all night clubbing and going to raves?
I said to you in the notes that I wrote about this when I was thinking about these tracks that I just wanted to sort of have something that was emblematic of the beginning of all that for me and then sort of coming towards the sort of end. And I think, you know, even though there were obviously, you know, it wasn't all kind of a joyride. The whole of the 80s from the beginning, you know, like that 79, 1980 period from the last track through to this track, which came towards the end of the 80s, you know, I felt really lucky to have lived through it at the age that I was. And really, and people say, oh, the 80s are awful. The 80s was awful. And I think, what are you talking about? And they also start sort of naming stuff that happened in the 80s. And of course, that was all going on. They also named songs that were, and often they're all commercial songs, like Rick Astley or, I don't know. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, it's like, what are you on? You know, a lot of people, and this is what slightly worries me, is when I'm in my dotage, in my care home, and I'm going to be, you know, the entertainment is going to be delivered by some silly 20-year-old who's going to go and look on Wikipedia or something, they're going to have a load of entries of songs from the 80s that were all like rubbish, that were all in the just sort of chart music, when my experience of the 80s would be something completely different, something really underground. And, you know, we went through every youth cult that there was, from being like, you know, New Romantics, we went into the goth scene, and that's the original goth scene, not what's, I don't know, you know, all the stuff that came later. We went into all kind of all the Dayglow stuff, which was great, with Culture Club and all the gender bending kind of glam rock kind of the second time round kind of stuff with Marilyn and Boy George, and that was brilliant. And then we went through all the hip hop, you know, all kind of stuff around hip hop, which was really kind of coming up through the 80s with, you know, Public Enemy and LL Cool J and all of that Def Jam. That was brilliant. And then and then into the acid house, rave, you know, kind of Right to Dance, Shut Up and Dance, blah 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 blah. The end.
Did you go to raves in fields and warehouses?
Yes, of course, Toby. What a ridiculous question. You know, I went to biology and chemistry, and you know, we kind of like with friends driving around at Heston service station, sitting there listening to your pirate radio station, waiting for the next set of instructions about where to go down the motorway to get to the secret dance location. I was just in the clubs and partying throughout the whole of the 80s.
At that time, what was your career like? Had you had your first play on at the Royal Court? Was your writing and productions that you produced relating to that particular time at all?
That's a really interesting question. Yeah, so, I mean, there's all that frivolousness and, like, kind of, like, hedonism going on, and just, like, just needing all that energy. Got to dance, got to be out, got to know what's going on, got to be in it, all of that. And then parallel to that was all the serious side. And I'm a Gemini, so, you know, I guess that's what, you know, you're going to get. The serious side was about, you know, writing and developing my practice. And I was writing through all of that time. I was certainly kind of in the beginning of the 80s, well, sort of around 82, 83, starting to write. 84, my play was picked up by the Royal Court and produced by them, and then started my kind of relationship with that venue and with a director that was based there who kind of became a mentor. There's a marvellous guy called David Salkin who was really instrumental in supporting a lot of young artists and young theatre makers at that time. And then I wrote another play that was produced at Riverside, and that was all about club culture, actually. That was called Choice to Chocolate, and it was about the unemployment, which was rife in the 80s, you know, and the fact that 3 million people unemployed and people were kind of finding alternative things to do or not, and the tensions between generations. And that was that play. And then I wrote, David supported me to get an Arts Council commission as a writer, which I knew, didn't even know you could do, to write Blood, Sweat and Fears, which was really an examination of invisible disability, which is kind of where I felt so I had been throughout a lot of my young adulthood. But actually, at that time, when I was writing it, I had lost quite a majority of my sight. So I kind of was blind at that point, but I was still in processing, you know, what it was like to have an invisible disability, which is kind of how I saw my partial sight at the stage before. And I was kind of exploring that through sickle cell anemia, which was a condition that affects a proportion of black people and people from Mediterranean countries some Asian countries as well. But it's a condition where somebody who's got it can be all right some of the time and then go into crisis. And I kind of felt that was what my vision impairment was like during my partially sighted years, that even though it was there all the time, there were times when I didn't, you know, I could pass and not seem like there was anything wrong with me. Yeah, so I was writing through all of that time, actually, and sort of developing relationships with the theatre industry.
Anthem of a Decade and a Time there with Acid by D-Mob. Sorry, I shouldn't have done Acid, but there we go. We come to your next track, which I think it was part of a play that you produced for Extant Resistance. What is the track and where does it take you to? Because it's a big band kind of swing track.
Yeah, it's called Chloe and it's by Tommy Dorsey. And I chose it because I wanted to have something from one of our productions. And there have been quite a few either plays that I've written that have had music to accompany them or plays that we've produced in Extant. And music's always been really important. But I chose this track because we worked with a composer to take the basic track and then we extended it for dance sequences that the actors performed, like Lindy Hop and stuff like that, which was meant to just sort of depict their energy as these teenage resistance fighters in Paris. And we had them kind of dancing their way through a lot of their action, which took place, you know, in this underground way in the city during the 1940s under the Nazi occupation. This kind of music just reminds me of the music that was in the films that my mum used to watch that she had grown up on during her childhood. And then we revisited on Saturday afternoons on jumble cell televisions when these televisions would allow us to, because they were always breaking down. They were all the kind of dance routines of Fred Astaire in these films. And there was always this big band sound, you know, to accompany these sequences. And so I kind of absorbed that style of music and learned to kind of really love it. And so we used it in Resistance because it was appropriate to the time, the period of the drama. But also, you know, I kind of feel like it was kind of, for me, it's kind of linked to my mum and her era.
The big band sound there of Chloe by Tommy Dorsey. Now, Maria, your final track that you want to pass on that might give hope to people for the future. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
Well, it's very personal to me and I'm not sure how much it's going to speak to hope for the future in any kind of really obvious way. But for me, this song or track rather is one that I've just pulled from a style of music that really, really reminds me of my dad and his generation and Nigeria, very specifically Lagos, in the 60s. When you play this kind of music to any young Nigerian now, they just laugh and want to run the other way, I think. But of a particular generation, this music kind of is emblematic of their kind of time. And it's a really good track because it's in two halves. So the first half is kind of a jolly, you know, sort of dancey type of jiggy song. And it's just about, you know, somebody expressing love for their girlfriend, you know. And then it moves into something that's a little bit more folkloric, a bit more percussive, and also is in Yoruba and is sung, the singing has got some really, really traditional kind of harmonies. And this really reminds me of when I was very young in Nigeria, and there would be kind of like groups of drummers that would come round to my grandmother's compound and play. And there's something really deeply rooted in me and this sound, and it's really connected to Nigeria and the place and the people and the earth. It sounds really hippy dippy, but it's really atavistic for me. And I feel like, in terms of hope, almost that beyond language, there's a place that we kind of all need to get to that is outside of all of the constructs that we construct for ourselves as people, as, you know, in our identities and all of this, which are all very important, but also aren't the end of the story. The story is about us as humans who are living awarenesses on this planet. And kind of that's all we are, beyond all the clothing, all the skin, all the stuff, you know, that we have in our life. We have all achievements or anything. We are just presences here, right now. And there's something about this music that does this for me.
What's the title of the track that you've chosen, Maria?
It's Del Ojo and his all-star brothers, Bouncing Bono.
Well, thank you, Maria Oshodi, for sharing your tracks of your life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much, Toby. It's been a real pleasure and you've been great. Thank you.